of this Methodist movement in England, mainly publishing. And so the decree that went out from Caesar was that every Methodist connection would break down into groups of 10. They would come early, and in those groups of 10, the question would be asked and the request would be made, where is your penny? One penny per week from each of the people in each of these groups. Now, when they got together for that practical reason, financial reason, it turned out that, well, they thought, well, let's ask a few other questions. And eventually they developed a little list of accountability questions. And it's really humorous that the list includes things that we wouldn't normally consider putting on a list to ask church people. In fact, stop and think for a second. We wouldn't dare ask any church member in any American church practically today about anything. You know, we have a covenant, it's called the code of silence in our churches, whereby anybody can get by with anything so long as it doesn't show, you know, and no one would ever dare asking anybody in church if they had been doing what they're supposed to do for the Lord. But in their case, living as most of the Methodists did, down southeast in England, where there's this long protrusion of land like a dagger sticking out called the Cornwall Peninsula, there's a huge amount of shore in comparison to the amount of land. And it's almost impossible, probably to this day, it's impossible to prevent little boats coming in at night, either from Ireland or north from Brittany, the peninsula, which France itself doesn't control very well, different language and different culture and a rebellious group of people there in Brittany. And they go up north and they smuggle things into the into Great Britain that way. And the people who live out in the Cornwall Peninsula developed a highly expert connection for all such things. Well, John Wesley, he was from that area himself. He understood the need for smuggling, you know, to make a living. Everybody was involved practically. But he also had a real unusual biblical sense of commitment. And he didn't think it was lawful. And not only in this area, but in many other areas all over England, he said, look, if you don't think the law is framed properly, don't disobey it, change it. And he pushed things right up through Parliament, including the abolition of slavery and all kinds of other things, to prove that the government could and should be changed rather than rejected or disobeyed. This is very, very different from the American attitude toward authority. But anyway, so in these little Methodist groups, one of the things they ask the people, have you been smuggling this week? Another thing they ask, and I don't know where they get this out of the book of Proverbs, but they also ask, have you been bargaining for prices in the market? If you were an early Methodist, you were not allowed either to bargain in selling or bargain in buying. I'm not exactly sure why that was, except that Wesley had a very high regard for the value of time. And bargaining takes time. So now, in all of the world's major cultures, there's no culture in which fixed prices are the common thing, except in the English tradition. It is very likely that the impact of John Wesley contributed significantly to that rapidly eroding tradition. In any case, these little groups became the conscience of the Methodist movement. And the historians, the church historians, say, well, now, the Methodist movement grew on the backbone of these little accountability groups. The largest non-Christian religion in of any modern sort in Japan got the same, stole the same idea from John Wesley's tradition. Someone told him that if you want to really get successful in your religion, you better use these small accountability groups. And so Soka Gakkai is now something like 20 million people, and they employ these small groups like the Methodists. Well, back to the companies of 70, which we're trying to set up. Never in our history have we ever presumed or supposed that there would be fellowship between churches. we always presumed and supposed that the proper thing would be for a mission fellowship to be born within a single congregation. Now, of course, we've had, you know, incidental meetings from time to time, like a regional coordinators workshop, or we've had even perspectives groups that have brought people from various congregations. Recently in Connecticut, they said 12 churches were participating in the perspectives group there. But we've never suggested any ongoing, regular kind of fellowship, lest we fall into condemnation from the pastors who don't like too well for their people to be meeting with other people from other churches, lest they be carried off to the other churches, I suppose. However, we are in it up to our necks at this point. We are obviously in print now. We sent the last 42,000 issues out, suggesting that people do get together. Now, the man I called in Glendale last night, formerly a vice president at USC, he could invite some people over to his home once a month or maybe once a quarter and try to encourage the people to compare notes. What are the solutions that you have in your church? What are the problems? And so forth. Every good thing that we want to do, like sell the Bill and Amy Stern's book, can be sold in face-to-face contexts like that, recommended, talked over, encouraged more easily than any other thing we could imagine, as far as I can see. Now, if perchance the financial need that brought John Wesley into this activity back in about 1775 or so could generate the same kind of fellowship across church congregational boundaries in our case and bring into focus some of these basic problems of the American church, such as recognizing the mission field of the Uzbeks in New York City, recognizing the fact that missions is not going where it's hot and where there are flies and snakes necessarily. That doesn't define the mission of the church. And to recognize that we're in an exciting and very optimistic countdown to the year 2000, when it is conceivable that all of these groups could have some significant penetration. Then, perhaps and only then, can this job be done. There is really no use in perfecting missionary training methodologies, in improving our knowledge even of the Earth's surface, or of methods of learning languages. All of the mechanics of mission are secondary in terms of the urgent needs of our hour to the fact that there is so little interest, so little awareness of what the task consists of, so little commitment to making the sensible decisions and choices at the local level that would allow for these marvelous opportunities right under our noses to be reached out to. So I just leave you with this challenge. Since tonight we heard about a mission field in the United States, we realize that most mission agencies do not operate and perhaps do not imagine the possibility of operating in this country. The agencies that are reaching out to these foreign peoples from foreign countries are very poorly equipped to learn their languages or understand their culture, for the most part. In fact, in very few cases do ministries to internationals involve any language learning at all. As, for example, in the case of the Navajos and the other American Indian populations, when the agencies that were operating overseas about 90 years ago ceased working in the United States and turned that work over to the so-called home mission boards, language learning stopped. In fact, Wycliffe Bible Translators was born out of the frustration of a man whose mission agency, he was working among the Apache in Oklahoma, Ella Legters, his mission, the Dutch Reformed Church, actually prevented him. They ordered him not to bother to learn the language. And as he was conducting the funeral of Geronimo, that famous Apache warrior, and was forced to use English, he realized that very few of the people there could understand what he was saying. Now, he actually developed a sign language, which he used very effectively in preaching to the Indians, thinking that that wasn't against the rules because the mission board hadn't thought of that. But later, he went to Guatemala. He ran into Townsend, and it's a long story. It's a book that's soon to be published, telling how this frustration with really incredibly inadequate strategies in this country led then to a global revolution. In Guatemala, as in many other countries, the minority languages of the countries were being pushed off in favor of, you know, missionaries. They can't learn all the languages of a country, so they learned the national language, the major language, thinking that that's good enough. And then all these other languages of minorities in all the countries of the world, which is true of almost every country in the world, would have to, you know, join the church that they planted in the major language of the country. Cameron Townsend and other missionaries, actually Cameron Townsend learned this from the other missionaries when he got to Guatemala, older people that I actually knew before they died. Cameron Townsend got the vision from them. But it was Townsend who had the organizational inclinations and insights and genius to found what is now the world's largest Protestant mission agency, committed to the languages of the minorities. But this organization is one of the few that actually works in the United States. They have about 65 missionaries working in the United States and in Canada. I'm not sure how many are in Canada and how many in the United States. But we need really more than ever to back up Art McCleary in his Doorstep Opportunities organization and their insights, and to back up these missions that are making tentative steps into the United States. It takes a mission from London, People's International, to work. And I suppose the people in England are glad to support somebody in the medieval barbarities of this country. But our own people are in the best position to reach these people, but we are further behind in terms of our understanding of the problem than probably anybody else. So let's do pray about this challenge, which we've heard tonight, and to see the larger dimensions of it in terms of mobilization in this country, and then more specifically, the kinds of things that we ourselves might do to help to break the logjam.